formed with the greats, late Mankunku and many others. And also we have the bassist, Kim Tswayeti, also from Cape Town, also moved to Cape Town and Johannesburg, who have also performed with a number of musicians from Mankunku as well, to Zing Nawane and so forth. And we have a young, beautiful dancer in class who just graduated from UCT and she's working. So what we are going to do is to ask them, this is more of a call and response. Mine was no rehearsal. I just gave them the brief. I said, look at the statue, we'll meet here. So what we are going to do, similar to what Manoba did, to take a classical piece called Lakuchoni Lana, which was composed by Makeda Vashe, and to take that classical song and ask the young dancer who's more contemporary to do exactly what Manoba did, but in their different register, to combine this classical sound and also the kind of improvise. So that said, it's going to be like 5, 3, 15 minutes, then thereafter I'm going to open for discussion. Thank you. Thank you, Amy. Amy Klassen. Rudy Twaibi. Mama Ngeti was Sylvia Mtunyelwa. I'm Thembi Nkosi Gwenyiwe. As I said, my interest was not so much to do the dry analytical discourse, but is to ask what this kind of performance does. It does a number of things for me, and I'll just talk about three here. One is, Chika talked about this notion of the intelligent form, the form. How do we begin to look at form? Because there's a tendency, in particular in South Africa, when we look at black artists' work, not to look at the aesthetic, the way in which they produce, or the way in which they speak. Very seldom we speak about their inventions. That is to say, what it is they bring to the world of creative production. We tend to spend much time in analyzing content, talking about the socio-political and all issues. So part of what I've been trying to do working with this performance artist and musician is to force me to enter that space, because they do less with talking than acting. They create. So now I'm asking myself, if I were to speak about that statue, in what way they will open it up? Of course, that will need another time, but what it does then, this performance, because I'm looking at her body, she's moving in space. Her body speaking is talking. And I'm listening to the sound, the melody. There's this conversation. So I'm asking, isn't that also what artworks do? Where, for example, form, where, for example, light, line, color, contrast, when they begin to collide, when they begin to speak to each other, isn't when we start to see things happening? Isn't that moment of more of meaning and form? Whereas in the case of this statue, I'm sure everyone can see, so small here, I should have projected it. So, to open it up and enter inside it, you know, it is that I'm interested in, that's one. The second one is also to ask, if this statue were to think about it outside of its context, are we risking to misinterpret it, to distort it, or are we expanding it? Are we giving it other lives? In other words, if we talk about tradition, or if this has become also a classic object similar to this song, so if we play it, we replay it, we reimagine, is it another form of keeping it alive? How do we keep tradition alive? One way is to reimagine it. And jazz musicians, they do that very well. They will play old standards, but they will give it different versions. They will give it different articulation. Why that is not the case when we begin to look at these historical objects such as the statue, for example? That's another question I'm interested in. How do we expand? How do we keep this heritage alive? You know, that has led me also to pay attention to one of the failures of South African artists, in particular black artists. If we look carefully, even when we look at Mangoba's work, even when we look at Sekot and many others, to a greater extent, they have not utilized their tradition. They have not went back to what their heritage is. They have relied in the main, in the kind of, this modern development, most of which, of course, are coming from the West and other parts of the world. And there's nothing wrong with that. We learn, from different parts of the world. But what it seems, what we haven't found is, even when you look at works such as Esther Mahlangu, in terms of those images of Ndebele, why modern painters, contemporary artists, are not making use of that tradition, that heritage? And sure, Chika will help us here. Whereas the Nigerian artist, as he has done with the argument, referencing Olu and Onobulo, the argument, when you look even with Ucha Okeke, for example, what they did when they begin to question the British education they were given, they didn't only question, but also they went to certain traditions that were part of their culture, to visit that, to reimagine it, and create a new aesthetics. To what extent has that happened in South African trajectory of modern art?
That's another question I'm interested in, because I haven't seen it. Even the great artist I just worked with, David Kolwane, he depended more on the urban influences, on contemporary or modern artists, most of whom are influenced by the city. Even himself, when he will talk about artists such as Jackson Hlongwane, Nurema Basso, even Esther, but visually he never stay claim in the so-called heritage, wooden sculptures, murals of the Ndebele. So why that is not the case? Because when you read the European artists, whether it's Picasso and many others, they took the luxury of looking at traditional forms from Africa, from other parts of the world, in order to inform not only their content, their language. That's how they managed some of them to break through and create new forms of visualizing, you know, their setting. But when it comes to South African artists, in particular black artists, that seems to have not been the case. That's part of why I'm thinking, how does Michelle help me to think that? The last point also I wanted to make here is the notion of modernism itself. I stand for correction here. My research so far has not provided in any of the South African literature a definition of what is modernism in the context in which we are working in South Africa. If there's such a definition, it relies so much on already established definition that many come from Western Europe. Even in our own languages, whether it's Xhosa, whether it's Sotho, whether it's Zulu, it's Venda, Tsonga, and so forth, you know, of course my Afrikaans is too poor, so I cannot speak about that. Surely there's something there. So when are we also going to make use of language, not only as a form of communication, but also as a concept developing, as a framing device in which we talk about this so-called local production, but not to fix, to ghettoize them, to see them in a broader context, but we begin to respond to what Fanon said when he was closing his Wretched of the Earth. We need also to invent new concepts in order to speak about the world that is changing. So how do you begin to do that when you're not paying attention to languages that also are so rich, that are part of your heritage? That was the third point I wanted to make. So through this kind of performance, I'm still exploring. As I said, I thought I'll just throw it out for discussion. Thank you.
Like, how do you see your talk and your performance? Do you want responses, or should we wait? Do we wait there?
It's up to you. It's up to you.
Does anyone want to respond to something? I know I'm sending mixed signals. Like, she's a time dictator, and she's asking for responses. Make up her mind. But it's good. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe Alicia has a question.
I wanted to hear you.
Say that again?
I wanted to hear you on the connection between Ernest Mola and David Kolwane.
Thank you. That was going to be part of what I've written, was to respond to Ntongela Masilela, one of the great literary scholars who have developed this notion of new African movement. And there's a series of essays where he studied the early intellectuals such as the Xhosa missionary school thinkers, Tiosoga, Jabavu, and many others. And there he provides a number of criteria, and also he brings this periodization. One of the problems with modern artists, he begins to say that movement began in the late 1800s, around 1888, something like that. And then it died, it ended at some point around the early 20th century. And then it goes on, by the time the Sophia Town comes into existence, in terms of the drum magazines and all that was happening, that movement is finished. When you read that, it's a very problem, kind of periodicity, which you get in the European sense of modernism from mid-1800 to mid-20th century, right? So this kind of the pre and that which it is, and then the post. So I'm saying, no, that's not true. There's always overlap. And in fact, there's this working through. So now what he does, he writes these other artists who are studying this kind of so-called emerging development, because some of what are those early writers and early artists were doing, whether Mangcoba Sekoto. When they left, the tragedy of modernism didn't stop. Whether like Dumile, for example, whether Lehi, whether like Sidney Kumalo, and many artists. And even in the 70s, with the artists who were mainly influenced by the BC, the likes of Figile Magadlela, Tami Myele, and many. And then you get again in the 80s, you know, especially with David's project, the Tupelo, having worked with the likes of Bill Ainsley and many other artists, right? So by the time David emerges in the 90s, so this project of modernism is still extending in different kind of incarnation. So to periodize it, it creates a problem. That was the link I was going to make, as to say, in my interest, is that David is not the last. We might read him, quote unquote, either as a belated modernist, but also a reluctant one, because the conversation I had with him, he refused to be kind of fixed in these categories. He saw himself as a contemporary. But what I'm saying, that's why my title from Mangcoba to David. So as I said, because of this excitement, I thought I'll put that for another occasion in the paper.
No, I think mine is not so much of a question, but more of a comment on how you, when we think of Mangcoba and archive, we never think of the sonic aspect of it. I'm also thinking that Mangcoba at one point was living in Cape Town before he departs from Europe. And the kind of music at the time that he was listening in, or it was listening at here in Cape Town. And also thinking, linking it with the documentary that is done with him about the first retrospective where there's a choir, they sing with a song. And so the son, for some reason, changes to China. And but there's something within that score, in that kind of tempo, that, because also this particular one gives us a different way to understand what is a gesture of understanding what prophecy, also about complicating the line, untangling the line. But also in reading Mangcoba, not just focusing on what is written in the archive, but also what do you understand as a living archive in Mangcoba's work also.
Yours is more of a comment than a question, I suppose. Yes, part of, as I said, as I'm reading Dongela, although it doesn't delve into the question of the choir, one of the things with missionary, you know, they gave ground to the kind of music that we see today in different forms, especially the choir, you know, and surely, one way or another, Mangcoba also was affected, especially Shoprofa, Wachela will talk about that moment of his at 410. Because in the early 30s, especially late 1800, you'll find really strong tradition of singing, not only within the church, but also in communities. And then you get some of the jazz, you know, and mostly the classic jazz musicals are derived from some of these hymns, some of these kind of choir sounds. So my interest, even with Davisha's sound, it has this melodic, it has this kind of, you know, haunting sense of when you listen to it, because what she says, as Mamu Mtunyela was saying, is, you know, when the sun sets, I'll go looking for you, you know, I'll go to hospitals, I'll go to. But of course, that is a comment around the time, you know, where, for example, in particular black men, including women as well, where they will leave the house for work or in search of work or for whatever, they might not make it back, right? So the song comments on that. But the beauty of the song, you know, it has this aesthetic feeling more than the lyrics. That's what holds me the song. So I'm interested, when you begin to listen to music, you're not only arrested by the lyrics, by the words. This is the form I'm interested in, because what we tend to do when we look at artworks, we run quickly to what it means, than in the way in which the meaning is unfolding, is manifesting. Whereas musically, you have to pay attention to the craft of playing, right? To the chord sequence, to the melody, to the tone, to the affect, in other words. So that's what I'm trying to find out by working with these performances and musicians, to force me into that space of aesthetic thinking, than always and already this notion of what it means. So in thinking of sound, of course, for me, there's something also about sound, because sound travels easily. It crosses boundaries with ease, right? It penetrates. So what I'm asking, in what way can I think about visual arts in that way? Because visual arts, they have a sense of being opaque. You look at them, it bounces back in most cases. But of course, it enables you to travel to other avenues that you have to imagine. You have to do that work of imagining. Whereas music, it offers you that. I can close my eyes and also hear and feel it at the same time, but also discern as well as digest the meaning. Whereas in visual arts, I can look at it, close my eyes, then I can imagine. There are many ways in which, so in other words, the idea of the sound is just to force me to think around how do I deal with form. Yes. Yes.
My comment goes somewhere towards your rhetorical question of what is happening in the vagina at the same time to performance, but also this lack of a working definition for modernism from within the South African art historical context. So, of course, Kofi Agbawu writes about the catastrophic impact of tonal harmony on African forms of music. That we see let's say, famous records like the music of Kalahari's Son, which obviously influenced composers like Herbie Hancock, all that information. So the destruction of the catastrophic impact of colonialism, contact with the tonal harmony, specifically the choral tradition, then comes to the missionaries, as you said, erased so many forms of African composition. So at the same time, I suppose, lack of definition of the working definition of modernism would follow the geometries and mathematics of Africa, all those different geometries and mathematics have also been erased by contact with colonialism. Catastrophic, whether it's Benin City, with nobody understanding the fractal mathematics necessary to have built that city, or whether it is with, as you say, the patterns. Perhaps our lack of a working definition reflects our lack of understanding or connecting with the geometries of the mathematics that we lost, whereas in Europe, as we know, whether it is Malevich, Korchenko, or Mondrian, they all said that they were trying to find an equivalent for the discovery of transfinite mathematics by their counsel. So, perhaps the question is I can't answer the question, but I think this lack of understanding the geometry that Mongolo was working with, the mathematics that Mongolo was working with, and the importance of geometry and mathematics to, shall we say,
perhaps the lack is a bonus because it forces us to search. Because once we have it, we tend to settle for things. Maybe that lack, it's something that we need to work with in order to find something. Yes, also we give too much credit to the colonial project, as if those who were affected, they didn't have agencies at the time, right? Those resistance were also forms of producing new things out of those contacts. So I don't think the catastrophe is kind of a destruction altogether. Instead, it offered new grounds for new ways and new subject. Where also the so-called colonized subject, they reinvented themselves. At the very same time, they forced the colonizers to think different about themselves, right? So this kind of dialectic in terms of binary. So you have to be careful at times when you talk about colonial intervention, as if the indigenous were just passive consumers on that. That's one, but also the surviving forms of creative production. Take, for example, for some of us who grew up in Xhosa, Namakwitch, those things have succeeded beyond the colonial catastrophe. siyombela siyaqhenza. And some of musicians are beginning to retrieve those. And also like visual artists are beginning to reference. Even when you read carefully the likes of Nicholas Hlobo, the work is not only naming a such, Xhosa naming, it's also going to certain kind of cultural materiality of what it means to be Xhosa in that context. So in other words, it is that is of excitement for me. So I'm just trying to, I'm with you on that, but I want us to be careful to always endow the colonial project with this, you know, totality over the indigenous cultures.
I'm just also thinking that maybe our next speaker performer might have an interest in answering that question as well, because that was something he's been researching. So it's a matter of like a dialogue, just like retrieving questions that have been asked also on an ongoing basis.
I think Prof wanted to ask something.
Well, just an observation. In fact, the point you've just made now, I was quite intrigued if you relate it to the shifts you were speaking about. You go back to the sort of alien places you were looking at, the kind of cultures, identities, broke out in that late sort of colonial period in 1800s with your early African intellectuals. What intrigues me is what you were analyzing tends to parallel what is the mainstream writing of social history in South Africa. That kind of shift from more kind of rural-based entrenched kind of identities, and then gradually as you take it into your 20th century, into sort of your shanty town, so far and the sort of reportrayal, if there are any continuities in that.
I want to have answered that. As we were speaking, Prof, something came to me, and something I'm wrestling with, again, with this notion of modernity and modernism. Its confinement within the urban is another problem, as if within the countryside, within the rural, there are not modern subjectivities. And with that project, which is great, and Dongela does very great work, most of those projects, because the missionary, they settle in the deep rural. So if you talk about modernity, as far as Ntongela's new African movement, he's talking about the rural setup. And yet when we write it, we privilege it, what we call it, the cosmopolitan setup. You know what I mean? So again, you know what I mean? And especially with Xhosa literature and also other indigenous literature, you'll find most of those early literature settings, they are mainly within that rural. Even if there's a tension of moving from the rural to the urban, this conflict between the urban and the rural. But that, for me, is an exciting kind of project of modernity. So maybe we need also to reshift this focus of always focusing on the metropolitan.